Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, strap on your hiking boots, grab your trusty walking stick, and don't forget your machete as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
This is Monsteropolis, a show about monsters, anomalies, and legends. I am one of your hosts. My name is Seth Breedlove. I'm joined, as always, by my faithful companion who has probably spent way too much time with me in the last, the last few months, but Mark Matzke.
Hello there.
This week we are talking about mysteriously missing people. I have a feeling we both took this topic in different directions, but that's okay. That's part of what keeps it fun. Before we get into the show, we want to talk about a couple things, address a couple things. That makes it sound like there's some sort of controversy going on.
Going to set the record straight.
The show is on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, all that. Leave us a rating and review. That helps a great deal. Share on social media. We're still trying to grow the audience back to anywhere near what it was with our previous show, Sasquatch, a podcast about Bigfoot. And we are on the radio at 97.1 FM, streaming and on the radio. What time? Do you know what time the show?
Yeah, I think it's Sunday night at 8 or 9 o'clock.
Okay. 8 or 9 o'clock Sunday.
We'll confirm this.
Yeah, we'll figure this out. Leave a rating and review. If you're not following us on social media or on Facebook and Twitter, no Instagram yet. And you can send us emails to monsteropolismail@gmail.com. I have not checked our mail. We might do that between the show and the next show and try to get into that.
Sundays at 9.
You can listen to the show on the radio. And actually, we had a guest at the Canton Palace Theater screening of On the Trail of Bigfoot last week who discovered us through 97.1 FM and listening to Sasquatch back in the day.
No kidding.
Yeah, he called himself the biggest fan. He was the last question, the guy that asked when we were bringing Sasquatch back.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, and he's in Oroville, which I didn't know their range reached that far because that's like 20 minutes from here. But apparently that's where he discovered us, was on 97.1 FM. So, we are going to talk about an event we're both going to be a part of at the end of this month. What are the dates? I know the movie screening on the 27th, April 20. I think it's 26th, 27th, and 28th. But yeah, April 26th, 27th, and 28th in Portland, Maine. Is the fourth annual cryptozoology conference, and Mark Matzke, myself, Andy Matzke, and Adrian Breedlove, all members of the Small Town Monsters family, will be present for the conference. Mark, you and Andy are actually speaking, correct?
That's correct. We are on Friday night after the VIP meet and greet and buffet dinner.
Oh,
Andy is first up.
The buffet. Thank you.
He's doing a presentation on growing up in cryptozoology and how
to maintain your sanity.
Yeah.
That should be a big theme.
Right. And so it's fun to watch him kind of developing that talk. It's almost going to be like Andy's TED talk on cryptozoology. It's rather
I got to bring Tommy.
Amazing. Yeah.
For that.
And then I'm right after him doing a half-hour presentation on the Peninsula Python and the development of the story with that. And then Anna Nakaris is after us. We're setting her up.
Mm-hmm. Opening act.
Yeah, we're opening for Anna. And she was last year's cryptozoologist and of the year and Golden Yeti recipient.
I never gave her the trophy, so I would maintain that I am still the cryptozoologist of the year.
Clinging to it. You can't have it.
You can't.
Nakaris.
I'll fight you to the death.
So that's just the first night. And then,
gets pretty crazy.
The next day is filled with amazing presentations such as Ken Gerhard. Cliff Berrickman's going to be talking about founding a Bigfoot museum. And there is, I think, a late entry into the schedule is Edward Guimont.
Snowden.
Edward Snowden streaming live from an undisclosed location.
It's kind of strange. Yeah. to a cryptozoology conference.
Yeah. And then let's see, like around 6:30 p.m., you will be debuting.
Oh yeah. This is the debut of Terror in the Skies. I don't know yet if we are locked into calling it a premiere, but technically, no matter what I say, it is the premiere because this will be the first time an audience sees it. It will be coming essentially like 10 days after the movie is locked. So you're definitely going to be the first audience anywhere to see this movie. If you're at the event, so Terror in the Skies will be debuting there, which is kind of a fitting thing because Lauren is really one of the key characters in Terror in the Skies. The story, there's two sort of main voices in that film. And he's one of the two. So it's fitting that he plays kind of a key role in being at the premiere.
It was like a homecoming for him.
Yeah.
In many ways, I think.
It was one of the highlights for me are those shots, where she's walking across the field down that road, even though he almost got hit by a car.
Oh, no. Is that in the outtake reel?
No.
Him dodging the...
No. He had like a cold or something, too. It was kind of a miserable trip, I think, for him. Like, he had to fly in, I think he left Portland at like 3:30 in the morning, got in at like 7 or 8. Jason picked him up, drove him directly to our... loft where we were shooting interviews / staying, and we filmed his interview there, and then he was out with us the entire day until almost sundown. Then I took him back to his hotel and dropped him off, and that was the last I saw of him for that on that trip. But yeah, we'll do a screening, and then he's allotted quite a bit of time. It's 7 to 10 o'clock at night, and the movie's only about 1 hour and 6 minutes. So I have serious doubts that we are going to do a Q&A that lasts 2 hours, but you never know, I guess.
Yeah, there's somebody else on the schedule then, too.
Okay.
Bill Darman, director.
Yes.
Mandate 33, new feature film, The Hill and the Hole.
I must be looking at the older.
Because he's 8:30 to 10.
Okay.
Is the
that
slot.
Explains it. So I go 7 to 8:30. Well, that makes sense.
Though. Yeah.
Bill's a good guy. Sunday, the event goes on again through Sunday. I believe it's a little more, laid back on Sunday. And we're there through Sunday. Actually, we're staying Sunday.
We are too.
Are you cool?
Yeah.
We'll have to go get some of those, lobster rolls or whatever at that place we found a couple
Absolutely.
Years ago. But yeah, we're really excited about this. It's a lot of fun. As long as I'm talking about events, there's another event. That I'm a part of coming up in 2 weeks, the Kent Paranormal Weekend, and that is taking place April 12th and 13th in Kent, Ohio. We are doing a special one-time screening of On the Trail of Bigfoot. This is probably going to be the last screening of that extended cut that we showed at the Palace. It's an hour and 43-minute cut of On the Trail of Bigfoot where we condensed the series down to episodes 1, 3, 5, and 6. By the way, what did you think of that? I didn't even get to what did you think of that cut of the movie?
I liked it.
Yeah.
I
don't know. I don't know that I'm buying what you're saying.
Well, no, I'm trying to see. But the problem is we saw that. And then the next day we did the commentary from beginning to end, the whole 3 hours. So I'm trying to actually remember what some of the distinctives were. Well,
the biggest cut was three. I cut out the pre-credit sequence where it introduced Minerva Monster with the sound, with the original sound and the drone footage. It went right into me talking to Barbara.
Right.
Out of episode one. And then episode three led directly into episode five with footage of me flying my drone and stuff, which actually isn't in the episodic version of the series. Oh, I just found a way. I basically discovered a way where I could use the same narration from episode three that led into episode four originally and just swap out the Chestnut Ridge footage for Oklahoma footage.
Okay.
So I actually really like that transition.
Yeah.
And it was when I watched it back, I was like, this would have worked like much better if I had those two.
So kind of back to back. That scene where you can see you at X. That's the only thing.
No, that's not in the episode. That's the only footage of me actually in X.
Yeah.
Those are drone shots. But yeah, that's going to be Kent Paranormal Weekend Saturday. What is that? April 13th?
Yeah, Saturday the 13th.
Saturday the 13th. I think that's at like 4:30 in the afternoon. It'll go until 6:30, something like
that's
that.
That's young Andy Matsky's birthday.
Oh, I guess I won't April be seeing 13th. You guys the Kent Paranormal.
I don't know. I have no idea what we're doing that day.
Yeah.
I brought it up to him, the Kent thing.
Yeah. And he was probably like, I'm sick of this. Seth guy. Yeah, we've got a lot. I mean, this is the official podcast of Small Town Monster, so I feel a little
official.
Yeah. So official. it's literally recording in the STM headquarters right now. But yeah, we've had a crazy, we just came off like the craziest STM weekend in a long time. We had a premiere, we had a photo shoot. I did, three different media, interviews in 2 days. One of them was television, which is super, stressful unless you're violently ill when you're doing it. And then all of a sudden all stress goes away because you're just worried about
survival.
I hope I don't die. Yeah. And that's where I was at. We had gotten, you know what we did? We went to Cheesecake Factory the night before.
Oh boy.
And it turned out to be a horrible mistake. Our audience is probably like, what is this show? Okay. All right. This week we're talking about mysteriously missing people. As I said, 13 minutes ago at the opening of the show.
You know what though? Since you talked about the, on the trail of premiere, I think we should shout out Matt from Moth Boys podcast.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. For
because
sure.
He provided us with kind of an exclusive thank you gift, I guess.
Yeah.
It was really unexpected. And what he got us was two t-shirts are the only ones that exist of us.
Yeah.
And as
which
Andy
no
said,
one's ever done.
You guys are you're a t-shirt now.
Yeah.
Which we were. It's a photo from the first Monsteropolis recording that we did at the Wadsworth Community Radio headquarters. And they took that and made it into a artistic rendition and then has a Monsteropolis title across the top.
Yeah, it's really rad. Matt Chang from Pittsburgh. And like Mark said, they do a podcast called Moth Boys, which is on like episode 3 or 4, I think. They just started a few weeks ago, so you can catch up before they really get going. And the show is all about if you're listening to the show, it's all about the stuff we all love. So cryptids and paranormal and legends, that kind of stuff. So thanks. Yeah. Big thanks to Matt. And thanks to Matt for driving all the way from Pittsburgh to Canton. Like that was the crazy thing. So we had this premiere and it was the biggest premiere we've done at the biggest screening we've done at the Palace, but it was actually in the top two largest audiences that have watched an STM movie, as far as I know, in one set, unless you might be able to correct me, but Whitehall was 500 people and this was just under 500 people. I can't think of another, maybe the Ohio Bigfoot Conference, the year we premiered Minerva, that would have been like 475, somewhere around there.
What was the first Minerva at the Palace with the speakers?
That was pretty small. It was like 175.
Really?
It wasn't big, yeah.
Okay.
It seemed big.
I conflated that in my memory,
so did
I think.
I looked back at ticket sales the other day, and that was what I was surprised to discover. But yeah, this was a really big screening, and I was just shocked at how many people drove from very great distances to be there. There was I think Tamara, or she goes by TS, but her and her daughter Mel drove all the way from like Southern Ohio, more or Midwest Ohio, West Ohio, 4 hours to be there.
Yeah.
And there were other people that drove from like Pittsburgh and Youngstown. There's people from all over came to see it. So it was pretty impressive for an SDM screening on a Friday night, especially because people, there's better stuff to do. Is that it? Did we hit everything?
Yeah.
Okay.
That sounds good.
All right. Let's talk about, so we just are coming off kind of talking about missing people and all that kind of stuff, but there was a lot that we hadn't hit yet. And, I know Mark especially had done a lot of like kidnapping, research, which is kind of, it's kind of strange, but, I started doing it last night and then I was like, I can't do this. I got freaked out immediately. So I went a different direction, than you did, but let's get into mysteriously missing people.
Oh.
We're going to do that every week. And then I play like,
I think I had the same weird reaction as you did. I mean, you start looking into kidnappings and it gets very disturbing very quickly because there's typically one of three reasons to kidnap somebody. One is for ransom.
Yeah.
Second reason is some type of family squabble. Mm-hmm. And it's a case of custody, basically. The third is to torture, maim, and probably kill the person that you kidnap. So it's pretty much limited to those three. And none of them are great. But it seems like the majority of the ones that make news are the worst of the three.
Sure.
So,
go
ahead.
In your research, did you find like what percentage of kidnappings end in the successful recovery of a victim? Like, I'm always curious about that. It seems like all you ever hear about are murders.
I think I wrote that down somewhere.
Okay.
It's depressingly low.
Okay, that's what I was wondering.
They fall far more into the realm of a disastrous end, tragic end.
Yeah, and if you're listening to the show and you're like, I don't want to hear about all this real world stuff, don't worry. I get into the more like paranormal side of things.
Yeah, so I'll just do a mysterious disappearance to start off.
Okay,
I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
This was from a book about disappearances in the Great Smoky Mountains, and it was a girl named Trenny Lynn Gibson. She was 16 years old. This took place on October 8th, 1976. The thing that's creepy about this is that it was a class trip type thing. They all got on a bus, went to Andrews Bald / Klingemans Dome parking area in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. There was one teacher supervising 40 kids. That's part of the problem.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a completely different era because what he basically did is let these kids go and do about an hour and a half hike one way to the destination and then come back and sort of meet me at the bus at 3 o'clock,
wow.
Basically.
Okay, yeah.
So that's what happened. This group of kids, they're all sort of grouped together in their own cliques and so forth and hiking this path. And about 3 hours into the experience, a rainstorm moved in. Trenny was seen by a number of her classmates. She walked away from a small group that one kid was like sitting down tying his shoe or something like that. She walked away from that small group and was never seen again by anyone. She was supposed to be back at the parking area at 3:30, and she was the only one that didn't reappear. A park ranger arrived about 4:30. The bus left to go back home at 5. So they didn't wait.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. There's a lot of really sketchy stuff that goes into this story.
What the heck?
The teacher, Wayne Dunlap, did stay behind and search with the park ranger. By this time, strong winds were buffeting the mountains with heavy rain. Temperatures got down into the low 30s. 19 searchers arrived between 6:30 and 8 p.m., and there were just no clues at all. There was nothing to indicate really anything unusual happening. It was just one of these just vanishing type cases. School officials had known Trenny was missing for over 5 hours before they called to inform the family.
Okay. Yeah.
So a full-scale search takes place on October 9th. That's the next day. It was your classic grid search with trained rescue people. Bloodhounds are brought in. Searchers found 3 wet cigarette butts and a can of beer that was still fresh near the place where Trenny disappeared, leading some to allege that somebody had been sort of
waiting,
camped out, yeah, waiting. How they would have known there was a school group coming in is a matter of some debate, although Trenny had been threatened by someone who is close to her peer group, actually. That plays into the whole story, but it's sort of been debunked later on. Mm-hmm. There was huge media coverage of this, like within a day of it happening. Media from all over the nation descended upon this area, and dogs tracked her scent to a through road in the park, and there were 8 cigarette butts found at that spot, the same brand as were found on the trail. So that's led some to theorize, you know, that she was abducted and whisked away, or that she got on the Appalachian Trail by mistake, mm-hmm, and just kept going. And this was on the fourth day, October 12th, the FBI got involved. Now, I mentioned somebody who had been connected to Trenny in the past. His name was Kelvin Bowman. He had actually broken into the Gibson residence and been shot in the foot by Trenny's mother, arrested and tried and sentenced. And in court, he made threats towards Trenny. Multiple sources put Kelvin Bowman at the school, and some even alleged that Kelvin had been following the bus that day, although he had an alibi, and it was later proved false. So it was like kids making up a story like, oh, Kelvin's following the bus, but it wasn't true, actually. So some weird follow-up things that happened in her case were that there were dozens of calls received that she had been seen after her disappearance, and they were followed up on, and none of them materialized as true. Mm. One that got a lot of coverage was an Elmer Husky of Knoxville, Tennessee, reported that a girl who looked like Trenny had come to her home asking to use her phone because her friends were having car trouble. The girl made a collect call, got no answer, went across the street to make another phone call. The girl got into a car with other young people and drove away. They got the make, model, and license plate and was positively ID'd as not Trenny later on in the investigation. So it was just a case of mistaken identity. The intensive search for Trenny Gibson ended on October 22nd. A second search was conducted April 18th through May 5th, 1977. Once again, it was harsh weather and a fruitless search ensued. The Gibson family ultimately sold their home. They moved away. The mom and dad got divorced, each remarried. So it basically destroyed the family completely.
WBIR out of, I'm assuming like Chattanooga or something like that. They did a story on it.
Mm-hmm. Have been lost in the Great Smoky Mountains. Some for just a few hours, some for days, but in modern history, only 4 still remain missing decades later. One of them, a 16-year-old girl who disappeared on a school hike. WBIR 10 News reporter Leslie Ackerson brings us the story of that teenager in tonight's Appalachian Unsolved.
The styles have changed tremendously.
A look through the pages of The Echo, and Bearden High alum Kim Pouncey travels back in time.
Yeah, we were the rebel group. We were kind of the group that hung out together in the smoking pit. So that's where most of my memories are, besides classroom.
The trip down memory lane brings many familiar faces.
There's me.
And a friend.
And then there's Trenny.
She hasn't seen in decades.
She had a great smile.
16-year-old Teresa Lynn Gibson, who went by Trenny.
And she would listen to Jethro Tull and hang out and just be kind of Trenny.
When Pouncey graduated in 78, Trini wasn't tossing her cap beside her.
I remember coming in to school that Monday and finding out that she was missing.
It was October 8th, 1976, their sophomore year, when Trini vanished on a school hike.
One important piece of like the missing people that gets overlooked, I think, a lot is the reality of people going missing and like how that affects, like you were talking about the family, the effect it had on the family. I think a lot of that gets left out because of the juicy, you know, the scary story side of this. The missing 411 thing is really blown up, and all these stories have become more of a like fun, scary side story. And I find that even people that claim to be, geez, I'm going to make a lot of enemies. even people that claim to be concerned about family are more into the like, oh, that's such a creepy story, let's tell more side of things than actually, you know, hopefully trying to help come to resolution or even looking at what the reality is for the families that were involved in this kind of stuff. Which is why I've always avoided that kind of, you know, the missing 411 stuff. Not that I think there's anything wrong with like I think you're somewhat into that stuff. Like you've always been into, at least to an extent.
Yeah, I've read some of the books, mm-hmm. and whenever Politis is on Coast, which mm-hmm. is quite a few times in terms of relative to other personalities,
right.
you know, I am interested in it, and it's sort of a macabre sort of interest. But I'm also, I have an ulterior motive because I, you know, of course, David Politis started out largely Bigfoot, mm-hmm. and I've been looking at the missing 411 cases, trying to see if he's ever going to allege a connection. And so far, he's played it absolutely mum.
Yeah,
and will not, even if there's a hint, I've never heard him telegraph that at all. So. It seems as if this is just a sort of a secondary path that he's taken, and it's really taken on a life of its own in his own investigation. But it's haunting. And like in the case of Trini Gibson, for example, I mean, it decimates the family. Her mother wrote a pretty moving book about her experience and detailed how it drove her deeper into her religious faith, because it was a religious family to begin with, but really her only way through this has been her personal faith. And that's sort of where the book ends is, you know, obviously her daughter never came back. So she's had to rely on, you know, a deeper truth.
Brandon Lawson is one that I discovered last night. This is his 911 call.
We're not talking to him. Hi, so you ran into him.
You ran into him. Okay.
That's the first guy.
Do you need an ambulance?
Yeah, no, I need the cops.
Okay. Is anybody hurt? Hello? 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 You ran into him. Okay.
That's the first guy.
Do you need an ambulance?
Okay, so
Brandon
Lawson, did you in your research into this, did you find any information on this case?
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of interesting. So this is actually, there's a missingbrandonlawson.com, and I believe it's operated by his family and like people that are still trying to find him. This is he went missing on August 9th, 2013 from Bronte, Texas. I don't know if this is a missing 411 kind of case or not, but mm-hmm. This is what I actually found directly from the website. So Brandon Lawson was an oil worker, father of four, last seen when he left his San Angelo home on August 8th, 2013 at approximately 11:53 p.m. after a spat with his wife, Kyle, and his girlfriend Audrey phoned us. Okay, so. What is known next is that following his phone call to his brother, something happened and Brandon phoned 911 telling dispatch he was in a field and needed help and that he needed a cop. That's what we were just listening to. The dispatcher heard Brandon say, "I ran into somebody," and responded to him, "ran into them? Okay." Another call was made to 911 by a passerby, a trucker, regarding Brandon's truck parked crooked on the side of the road, posing a hazard. When Kyle arrived at 110, Kyle was his, I believe his brother, or it says here somewhere. When Kyle arrived at 1:10 a.m. August 9th, 2013, there was no sign of Brandon. A sheriff's deputy arrived at the truck at the same time as Kyle and Audrey. There was no visible damage to Brandon's truck, and his keys and his cell phone were gone. It is understood that the deputy nor Kyle were aware that Brandon phoned 911 asking for a cop, as well as stating, please hurry. While talking with the deputy, Kyle received a call from Brandon, in which Brandon's cell was going in and out, and he was hard to understand. What Kyle understood was, I'm in the field. Kyle felt maybe Brandon was hiding in the field due to an outstanding warrant from 2 years ago that Brandon himself just learned and was going to address it the following week. So Kyle made no mention to the deputy of Brandon being the phone call he was listening to. Had Kyle known Brandon phoned 911, he would never have assumed his brother was hiding. At 1:18, Audrey texted Brandon saying, a cop is at your truck. It is assumed she did such as she wanted to warn him due to his warrant. At this time, they were not aware that he himself phoned 911 asking for a cop and to please hurry. In statements given to police, as explained by the family, they did admit Brandon's earlier call to them in which he told his brother and Audrey that he was 10 minutes up the road and was bleeding. This was also not reported to Deputy Neal at the scene. It is also understood that Deputy Neal did not report to Kyle that Brandon phoned 911. From all media reports written by the Observer Enterprise, owned by the sheriff and his wife, that the 911 call was only reported as a stranded motorist who ran out of gas. No mention of the urgency, nor any mention of I ran into them, as understood by the dispatcher. The deputy put emergency flashers on, locked the truck, and proceeded to leave the scene and arranged for a tow in the morning. According to reports, the deputy drove up and down the roadway to see if he could spot Brandon walking. Kyle and his girlfriend left the empty gas can in the bed of the truck, thinking if Brandon came back, he would have the can and could retrieve gas. They began to go look for him. When morning came and still no sign of Brandon, Kyle's money was available in his account. He went back to his truck, filled the can, and returned it to the truck. At this point, he was now starting to become concerned and felt that Brandon may not have been hiding and may be in trouble. In talking with investigators, he now gave them the full account of Brandon being on the phone at the time the deputy was at the truck. It wasn't known by Brandon's family that he called 911 until Brandon's wife, Ledessa, saw on the itemized cell phone transactions provided by law enforcement that a 911 was called. There's been no activity on Brandon's bank accounts or his cell phone since that time. An extensive search was conducted by professional search and rescue on October 24th, 2013, around the area of the abandoned truck. And there's pictures of him with his kids and his wife and everything. So another one of these, like, super fascinating cases, because like he's calling in and he moves, like there's movement as well. The call about being in the field is really strange. Like, it almost sounds like at that point he's there, like near where the truck is. There's this field, that's where they think he called from earlier, and he's saying he's in the field. In a way, it kind of reminds you of that 1800s report where the guy just walks into thin air out into the field and disappears.
Yeah.
Which was more than likely a hoax story, but
yeah.
There's some weird, like, modern similarities to that.
Yeah. I mean, it gives you that creepy sense that he's trying to be noticeable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, why can't you see that I'm here? Yeah. Almost, which is, that's pretty disturbing. Unsettling.
Yeah.
Did it say what his warrant was for?
No. No, it didn't. It just said he had an outstanding warrant. And that, again, like, that's their, I get the impression that's sort of the family website, like, trying to locate him. So some of those things are probably out there. I just, you know, I do my bare amount of research.
Because as far as a cause, it makes you wonder, you know, what type of trouble had he gotten into? And if he went by running into somebody, he meant he ran into the wrong people.
It could be anything.
Yeah,
it's, I do.
Super intriguing.
It is. I'll have to do some follow up on that one, because I am curious what would have. The only thing is, 2 years to having a warrant and not a warrant out for you and not know for 2 years. More than likely, he ran into something, like got in a car accident or something. Like, that doesn't seem like it would be terribly serious if he didn't even realize it was out for his arrest.
Yeah.
What do you got?
Well, I've got
Brandon lost
a plethora of kidnappings.
Oh, good. I can't wait.
So, I mean, there are some classic sort of historical kidnappings. You could always talk about, like, the Lindbergh baby.
Mm-hmm. That was one. That was actually, I think, when I initially said something to you about this, that was one of the things I wanted to talk about.
Sure. And
then I did no research into it whatsoever.
And there's Patty Hearst, of course. Well, let's do Charles Lindbergh Jr., because that sort of becomes a template for other kidnappings that are covered in the media in a huge way.
Yeah.
Now, this took place March 1st, 1932. Charles Lindbergh and his wife, Anne, had 20-month-old baby, Charles Lindbergh Jr., taken from his crib in Hopewell, New Jersey. It was reported at 10 p.m. A ransom note came in within days. First, the ransom note was set for $50,000. Within days, it became $70,000. Then the third, there were more notes beside. Point is, the ransom was paid, but Charles Lindbergh Jr. did not survive.
Yeah, and we located a newsreel relating to this case, found on the Critical Past website. There may not be... No, I'm pushing up the volume on the wrong thing.
...of the nation's law-enforcing agencies, out over the wires. And immediately, there begins the greatest manhunt in the history of modern crime. Only a few minutes have passed since the message was flashed. It isn't much beyond midnight. And already the state troopers are going through the neighborhood with a fine-tooth comb to meet the challenge of a criminal degenerate. Not a single bed is overlooked, not a single suspicion unverified in the search for the most famous baby in the world. Innocent, led, 20 months old son of the Lone Eagle and his mate. The victim of his cruel...
Yeah, this is like of all the kidnappings, this is like one of the only ones that I've actually ever spent any time like reading about. I got a book on it when I was a kid. Apparently, I was a weird kid, and this story had always fascinated me. I think because Lindbergh is such an iconic sort of character himself, and the case, I mean, this affected him deeply, obviously, as it would as a dad. But yeah, this case has always been something I've been kind of fascinated with.
What's really unsettling as well is that, you know, this happened in 1932. Apparently, kidnapping for ransom was rampant during the Depression, which I didn't really...
I said, yeah, like I knew that. Yeah.
Yes, it was.
Come on, Mark.
And it gives you a sense of the desperation that people had at that time and the lengths that they would go to try and pull themselves up. Lindbergh and Anne, they went on to have 5 more children, but they were never the same, as is always the case in a situation like this. And I remember reading something about, it was an interview, I think, with one of the other children, and how, you know, they would come in the room and sometimes find their mother or father just sort of absently staring or looking out the window, and they knew what was going on. And they were treated well. It wasn't as if they were neglected or mistreated as the siblings, but there was an empty space in that family and everybody knew it. Ultimately, in 1934, a man named Bruno Richard Hauptmann was arrested and convicted for first-degree murder and actually put to death in 1936 for the crime. Bruno's widow argued his innocence until her death in 1994. So there's a small bit of controversy surrounding the conviction and ultimately the execution of Hauptmann in the Lindbergh crime.
We had someone suggest something to us like a week ago, and I cannot find the name. Someone posted, did you see the post about the American Dyatlov Pass incident?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Do you know who that was? I couldn't even find the post, and I wanted to give them credit because they got me looking at it, and that's what I'm going to talk about, is what is kind of known as American Dyatlov Pass. And this is, I'm going to be reading this primarily from a story from 1978 that ran in the Washington Post called Five Boys Who Never Come Back. So I'm just going to read through this, and I'll probably skip over some things too, but I just want to go over this case because it is super fascinating. I don't know how much I'd refer to it as the American Dyatlov, but it's still really cool. The story starts out, there was a half moon that night, a winter moon in a cloudless sky. Up in the mountains above the Feather River, The snowdrift sometimes rose to 15 feet. You need a coat, Ted Wire's grandmother had said, watching him go. Oh, Grandma, I won't need a coat, Wire had said. Not tonight. 2 hours before midnight, last February 24th, when the basketball game ended at the California State University at Chico, five young men from the Flatlands, 50 miles to the south, climbed into a turquoise and white 1969 Mercury Montego? Is that it? Is that a car model?
Montego.
Yeah. And drove out of the parking lot. They were fans of the visiting team, which had won. They stopped three blocks away at Bear's Market, mildly annoying the clerk who was trying to close up, and bought one Hostess cherry pie, one Langdorf lemon pie, one Snickers bar, one Marathon bar, two Pepsis, and a quart and a half of milk. Then they walked out of the store, got back in their car, drove south out of Chico, and disappeared. Ted Wires woke up afraid at 5 the next morning. She cannot say what woke her up, except that maybe the Lord decided it was time to end her one last night of solid sleep. Ted's bed was empty. The house was still, and it was not quite light, and this is how the horror began, as it often does. No crash, no wailing, just a dim morning chill in a small house on what ought to be an ordinary day. Imogene Wire got on the phone and called Bill Sterling's mother as fast as she could. Juanita Sterling had been up since 2 a.m. Bill didn't come home either, she said. Mrs. Sterling had called Jack Madruga's mother. Jack also had not come home. Mrs. Wire called Jackie Hewitt's mother, and Mrs. Wire's daughter-in-law walked down the street to talk to Gary Mathias's stepfather. All five friends had vanished. At 8 that morning, Mrs. Madruga called the police. The boys had never done such a thing before. Let me see if I can skip through to some of the details of what actually happened. So, they were supposed to play a basketball game of their own on February 25th, part of a tournament with Free Week in Los Angeles that they won. Their clothes had been laid out the evening of the 24th before they left for Chico. Each had a beige t-shirt, the words Gateway Gators emblazoned across the chest from the Yuba City Vocational Rehabilitation Center for the Handicapped, where they all played basketball. Mathias had just about driven his mother crazy with the game. "We got a big game Saturday," Mathias kept saying. "Don't you let me oversleep." Saturday came and went, and no word came. The police began to take interest. On Tuesday, February 28th, they found Madruga's Mercury, and from that day on, nothing they found, nothing anybody told them, seemed to make any sense. The car was 70 miles from Chico on a deserted and rut-ravaged mountain road. It had stopped at the snow line, and although its tires had apparently spun, the car was not really stuck. Five men could easily have pushed it free. The gas tank was a quarter full. Four maps, including one of California, lay neatly folded in the glove compartment. The keys were gone, but when police hotwired the car, the engine started immediately. Both seats were littered with the wrappers of the food bought at Bear's. Everything had been eaten except the Marathon bar, which was half gone, and the city's underside was undamaged. This heavy American car with a low-hanging muffler and presumably with five full-grown men inside had wound up a stretch of torturously bumpy mountain road, apparently in total darkness, without a gouge or dent or thick mud stain to show for it. The driver had either astonishing care and precision, the investigators figured, or else he knew the road well enough to anticipate every rut. The family say only Madruga drove that car ever, and the family say Madruga, who disliked camping and hated the cold, did not know the road. None of the boys knew the road. Trying to skip ahead here because this is a very long story. A storm whistled in the day the car was found, dropping 9 inches of snow on the upper mountain. The search teams nearly lost men themselves 2 days later as their snowcat struggled through the drifts. Nobody found anything, not so much as a shoe, until after the spring thaw, when on June 4th, a small group of Sunday motorcyclists wandered into a deserted Forest Service trailer camp at the end of the road and inhaled a nauseating smell. It was Ted Wire, stretched out on a bed inside the main 60-foot trailer, frozen to death. 8 sheets had been pulled over his body and tucked around his head. His leather shoes were off and missing. A table by the bed held his nickel ring with Ted engraved on it. Wire had been a tall, it goes into some more detail about him. He was 19.4 miles from the car, Wire, wearing a striped velour shirt. Oh, this is the next Wire had been. Okay. Trailer had been broken into through a window. No fire had been built, although matches were lying around and there were paperback novels and wood furniture that would have burned easily. More than a dozen sea rations cans from an outside storage shed have been opened and emptied. One had been opened with an Army P-38 can opener, which only Madruga and Matthias had served in the Army, probably knew how to use. There was more food in there that was not touched. No one had touched the propane tank in another outside shed either. The search continues through the year. The boys had been seen in Tampa. Okay, so leads were drifting in and in from all parts of the country. The boys had been seen in Tampa. The boys had been seen entering a movie theater in Sacramento, accompanied by an older man. Ayers could punch holes in all of them. Skeptical but desperate, they consulted psychics. One told him the boys had been kidnapped to Arizona and Nevada. Another said the boys had been murdered in a Rowville in a two-story red house, brick or stained wood with a gravel driveway. For two solid days, Ayer drove every street in Rowville looking for the house. It did not exist. The search continues. Jackie Charles Hewitt, 24, 5 feet 9, 160 pounds, slight droop to the head, slow to respond, a loving shadow to Wire, who looked after Hewitt in a protective sort of way, would dial the phone for him when Hewitt had to make a call. Jack Antone, it goes through like each. I'm going to have to post this because like it's super fascinating. It's probably the most detailed version of the story I could find. Unfortunately, when you're trying to just give a synopsis of what happened, it becomes very difficult. There were sightings over this period of time of like people thinking they see the boys, the kind of all over the area. The day after Wire's body was discovered, searchers found the remains of Madruga and Sterling. They lay on opposite sides of the road to the trailer, 11.4 miles from the car. Madruga had been partially eaten by animals and dragged about 10 feet to a stream. He lay face up, his right hand curled around his watch. Sterling was in a wooded area scattered over about 50 feet. There was nothing left of him but bones. 2 days later, just off the same road, but much closer to the trailer, Jackie Hewitt's father found his son's backbone. Ayers had talked to him out of joining the search, fearing something like that might happen, but Hewitt, whose first name is Jack, had insisted on going. There were a few other bones around, along with Jackie's Levi's and rip-soled get-there shoes. An assistant sheriff from Plumas County found a skull the next day, about 100 yards downhill from the rest of the bones. The family dentist identified the teeth as those of Jackie Hewitt. Hewitt's remains had lain northeast of the trailer, like Sterling's and Madruga's, northwest of the trailer, about a quarter mile away. Searchers found three wool Forest Service blankets and a two-cell flashlight lying by the side of the road. Flashlight was slightly rusted and had been turned off. It was impossible to tell just how long it had been there. They found no sign of Gary Matthias. His tennis shoes were inside the Forest Service trailer, which suggested to investigators that he might have taken them off to put on Wire's leather shoes, particularly since Wire had bigger feet and Matthias' feet might have been swollen from frostbite. There were in the years to follow, there were supposed sightings of them, even though they turned up, like people kept claiming they were seeing them. Obviously the whole thing is a pretty big mystery. And one of the boys, I think whoever the last one, Gary, I don't think was ever found. So I don't quite see this as an American Dyatlov. It seems like there's something sinister at work, but I don't think it's paranormal in nature. It doesn't seem to be. The most paranormal thing about it is how on earth the car got to where it was without having, you know, it's driving. When they say rutted road, I think of the road into Area X or something. Like, how do you get up a road like that without knowing your way around the area? And the parents said he had no idea where he was.
Yeah. And the car is in pristine condition. Yeah, that's car's very in strange.
Perfect condition.
Yeah. What year was that again?
Not even mud on the car.
Yeah, right. Is that 70s?
That story was written in 78. I'm not sure on when the exact events happened. But yeah, That's a really fascinating one. We're going to have to end this show way over.
Yeah.
I'm going to post a link to that because I feel like my horrid rereading of that article probably left a lot of the details out, but it is super fascinating. And whoever the mystery individual is that posted about doing that for a future episode of Monsteropolis, thank you, because it is a really cool story. Not cool, but fascinating.
It's amazingly documented. Yeah. I mean, it's so detailed.
Mm-hmm. And I never heard of it until he had posted that.
Yeah.
So, all right. I don't even know how to end this. Yeah.
Go with a buddy.
Yeah. Don't.
Take care of yourselves.
Yeah.
That dear listener.
That last story involved five people.
Oh, yeah. Take lots of buddies.
Yeah,
then.
Take an army.
Move in a posse.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for listening. Leave a review. Follow us on social media. And come see us in Kent or Portland, Maine at the International Cryptozoology Conference. Thanks for listening.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com. It is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.